This presentation was given at the 2017 Oktoberfest Conference at the Orangeburg German Swiss Genealogy Society. Rights to the content of the presentation remain with the speaker.
Okay, welcome back everybody. I would like to welcome our next speaker, Charles Baxley. He's going to talk to us about some recent research he did at the battle site of Eutaw Springs. Mr. Baxley is from, I don't know if I can pronounce this right, Lugoff, South Carolina. He's a lawyer. He's been a judge in Camden. He does an online journal, Southern Campaigns of the American Revolution. And I just looked at this the other day, and there's a lot of good information on that website. He's on the board of the Historic Mapping Congress, and he has had articles published in the Army History magazine. So we're very pleased and honored to have him with us today. So give Mr. Baxley a big hand.
Thank you so much, Margaret. I really appreciate being with you this morning. I'll get over here by the mic so maybe you can hear. Are you okay on the back there?
Yeah.
Very good. I want to talk one second about a momentous occasion that happened in the world 500 years ago this weekend. It is when Martin Luther, kind of a disgraced monk, came out, posted his 95 Theses on the church at Wittenberg, Germany, and started the Reformation. The Reformation rocked Western civilization. Something almost as momentous rocked the world that happened in the South in 1779, 80, 81, and 82. That is the birth of self-determination, throwing off hereditary princes as rulers and going it your own as a representative government. That's what I'm fascinated with. Now, I wanted to thank a lot of people because I'm standing up this morning acting like I have done all this work, which is utterly untrue. There are many people who have contributed, and I've given you a very difficult to read list up there, including my friend Richard Watkins, who is here with us today. And so please don't think that I claim all the expertise that's been going on and the project that I've had the wonderful opportunity to work on. Okay, now, first of all, I am a Southerner, which means that I am obliged, even though you hadn't asked, to tell you who I am. Unfortunately, I'm really cruddy at genealogy, but I do feel absolutely at home. The Baxley half of me is absolutely 100% English. My father has done, out of curiosity, 23andMe and the other competitor DNA, and it is the most boring DNA report you could ever read. I thought that we at least had Pocahontas, but we have nothing but common English horse thief that got run out of town on that side of my gene pool. However, on the other side, I think I have good German-Swiss connections. So I actually started to write it down all the way to the immigrants and realized that that was a research project in and of itself, and I couldn't do it off the top of my head. But my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was harassed from Cameron, South Carolina, who came with Gass and Danner in 1730-something to Amelia Township. My mother's father is a Wise who is descended from Frederick Wise, who settled on Beards Creek. Unfortunately, the South Carolina Electric and Gas Company has flooded where his property was and made lakefront property out of it, but a little late. So I've got good German Wises, who think that they're from the area of Wittenberg, Germany, and good Swiss German-speaking folks who came to the Orangeburg and to the Amelia Township. So I want to tell you who I am. Unfortunately, you know, knowing my family lineages are not very good. People, my friends who are in the SAR all the time say, why don't you join the SAR? And say, I can't get in. My mother and my sister somehow can get in the DAR, but I don't think I'm qualified. So I don't know how that works. Anyway, so that's who I am. I wanted to talk to you a little about 1781 in South Carolina. General Nathaniel Greene has taken over command of the Southern Department of the Continental Army. Now, that is about the worst job you could have because there really is almost no logistical support to the Southern Army of the Continental. And I don't want to say none because there were a few wagons full of goods that trickled down the great wagon road from western Pennsylvania at the time through the Shenandoah Valley. The problem is that when all this is happening in 1781, the British have figured out that logistical system, and they've landed two officers, Phillips in the Petersburg area of Virginia, and a guy named Benedict Arnold, who y'all may have heard of, who had a British army and was ravaging the supply lines, as well as Lord Cornwallis had marched that way to stop Virginia from sending supplies south to try to cut the South off tremendously. So Greene, who has been George Washington's chief lieutenant in 1781, is sent south to bring some order to the remnants of the Southern Department, which were annihilated by the surrender of Benjamin Lincoln's whole army in Charleston in 1780, and annihilated again under Horatio Gates at the Battle of Cannon. So you have two huge whackings of the Continental Army and a lot of other Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina militiamen at the same time. And so the army is a shadow of itself with virtually no logistics. So we go forward. Nathaniel Greene has Cornwallis chase him almost into Virginia, the so-called race to the Dan, partially wearing Cornwallis out. Cornwallis goes to Wilmington, North Carolina, a seaport, so he can get resupplied from London, from England. And Greene says, well, I'm going to come back to South Carolina, and I'm going to clean up the mess that the British left behind. The British, by the way, had a post here at Orangeburg, among other places. Now, Greene fights at Hopkirk Hill, which is just north of Camden. Then he goes to 96 and unsuccessfully lays siege to it. But after both of these battles, he lost. The British knew that these posts were unsupportable because there was so much partisan activity sniping his supplies and communications that he couldn't sustain them. So the British pulled out of Camden first, then they pulled out of 96, leaving sort of the back half or the back country of South Carolina free of any organized British work. After the almost the grand battle happened almost right where we are, because Greene moved his army to Turkey Hill, which is just right across the street. Stuart, Rawdon, and John Harris Krueger had all joined in Orangeburg, and they just chose not to come out to fight. They wanted Greene to come fight them at fortified Orangeburg, and that didn't happen. So that's July 1781. Greene goes to the high hills of the Santee to rest, recuperate, and reorganize his army after a huge campaign and walking hundreds and hundreds of miles. And the high hills of the Santee is a big area, but basically think Statesburg, South Carolina. Lord Rawdon, who's the commander of the British internal in South Carolina, is sick. He's probably got malaria or something like that that comes and goes, and he wants to go home. He's tired. So he hands command off at Orangeburg to a guy named Alexander Stewart, a professional, competent British leader, lieutenant colonel, who has his eye on becoming a general. So Alexander Stewart takes command. Under him, he has John Harris Krueger, who is a Yankee from New York who... Oh, Doreen, please don't think I'm talking about your people now. I use the word Yankee kind of freely. Doreen's my friend. She'll forgive me, I hope. Maybe 20 years, but anyway. John Harris Krueger has successfully defended 96, so he was a tenacious loyalist from that hotbed of loyalism, New York City. So Stewart says, we're going to hold the Congaree-Santee River as sort of the line between the control area under control pretty much of the Whigs, the Americans, and the British are going to have sort of from the Congaree River west and south. He takes his army to Fort Mott, and that's where his base is. The problem, and one of the big things that happened with the British and big mistakes they made, is they thought that they could subsist British armies in the field off the local population without having to run huge supply columns, ships, convoys from England to do that. They were wrong. The population and the economy of the 13 colonies was not such that you could take 2,000 men and plop them down anywhere and sustain them for very long. Because the Fort Mott area had already, and Belleville had already been eaten out of house and home because they'd been fighting over it for 6 months. And when you bring a British or an American army to your farm, they burn all the rails, they eat all the fodder to feed the horses and the cows, because they got cows and sheep on the hoof because they didn't need refrigeration, not much salt to preserve meat, so you got to keep them alive. And then they send these scouting parties out, both teams did, to gather up all the supplies. So Nathanael Greene is really pretty close to Fort Mott. Really the only thing that's dividing them is the watery river swamp, about 3 miles of unpassable swamp, except maybe you can get through there in a canoe or a John boat or a sneak boat or something like that. It's hard to move an army across that river. Nathanael Greene says, well, I'm going to go and attack the British army, and this is late August, miserably hot, at Fort Mott. So to set off to do that, he goes north to Camden. And he's not going north to fool the British, because the British know what he's doing. They got gold to buy information. There's plenty of loyalists to tell on him. But he goes north to Camden because that's the first place that you can conveniently cross the watery river. So he goes to Camden, leaves his sick there, which is a good many people, crosses the watery river about where I-20 crosses the watery today, takes a diagonal through what is Richland County to Howell's Ferry. Howell's Ferry, Dick and others, and I and others have been out looking for Howell's Ferry. It's roughly the north end of the Congaree National Park. Goes across the river there, gets on the river road, and goes to Fort Mott. What he did not know is that Stewart was running low on supplies. And once again, the British had to ship supplies by ship to Charleston, put them on small boats, up the Cupar River, if I say Cupar right, to Munt's Corner or Fairlawn, put them on wagons, go to Nelson's Ferry, cross Nelson's Ferry, put them on wagons again, and go to Camden. That's how they got supplies. Or they could come up the south side of the Congaree Santee and go to somewhere like Fort Mott or Eutaw Springs. So Stewart decided to move his army from Fort Mott to Eutaw Springs to camp because it's closer to his supply line, to shorten up his supply line. So I've done a pretty crude map here, and I wish it was a little bigger, but this is where Greene is at the high hills. He goes north to Camden, kind of down highway number one, cuts through the, that green area right there is McIntyre, goes to Howell's Ferry, and then down here to Fort Mott. Starting here at Orangeburg, Stewart had come up to Fort Mott and camped there, but a couple days before Greene gets to Fort Mott, Stewart has gone down here to Eutaw Springs, camp at Eutaw Springs. Nathaniel Green is being extremely careful about trying to keep the British from learning of his movements. Nathaniel Green will be able to get within 3.5 miles of the British camp without the British figuring out that the whole American Southern Army is 3.5 miles away from him. Now, very luckily, we're able to read Alexander Stewart's emails. Now, Green couldn't. But Alexander Stewart wrote 3 interesting letters to his boss, Lord Cornwallis. And in the first one, he is in high gear explaining how come a whole army could get within 3.5 miles of his camp without him knowing about it. And he only found out about it when 2 Americans decided to defect and snuck to his camp and told him, hey, Green's right down the road and he's coming to get you. So that's what happened. And it's fun now that the papers are together where we can read what Stuart knew, when he knew it, and what everybody was up to. Boy, that is washed out. I am sorry. That is a beautifully colored map on the monitor up there, but it's very washed out. Green goes into camp at John Burdell's plantation. And John Burdell's plantation was just east of Vance, South Carolina. Now, Vance is a railroad town, so it's on the railroad line. There was no railroad in 1781, so Burdell's plantation was on a creek, which we call Mill Creek today. And it's right on Old Highway 6, about where you come out of the eastern side of the town limits of Vance, South Carolina. That's where John Burdell's plantation was. And so not only did Nathaniel Green get there with his whole army, Francis Marion and his band had been down at Parker's Ferry, which is Colleton and Charleston County, beating up on the British cavalry down there. And Marion rode all the way around the British lines and through the British lines and joined Nathaniel Green's army at Burdell's plantation on the night before the Battle of Eutaw Springs. General Green, coming out of Burdell's plantation, gets to the 4-mile point, which is right here. Now, I don't know, I'm sure some of you own here know Highway 6 very well. Modern Highway 6 kind of runs to the south like this through Eutaw. This is before you get to Eutaw on the west side. There's a turnoff on what's called the Old Monk's Corner Road, which is a dirt road. And there's a section of that road a mile or so long that still is a single lane, unpaved, fairly unimproved road through great oak trees that the hurricanes keep tearing up. And they get to this point about where the modern Highway 6 and the Old Monk's Corner Road divide. And that's about, say, 2 miles west of Eutaw, South Carolina. And they stop there. And they stop there for something very important. They've been up since early in the morning. And Green wanted to give his army a little refreshment. And a little refreshment for an army in the 18th century, even at 5 o'clock in the morning, is a gill of rum. And not only did he give them one, but he gave them 2, because he knew that that would help them out in their morning battle preparations to steady the hands a little bit. Because this was not a surprise to Green. He was going to Eutaw Springs to attack the British army that's camped there. Well, you know, I talked a little bit about the British supply problems. So Stuart is camped here at Eutaw Springs. Eutaw Springs is 1.5 miles diagonally at the headwaters of Eutaw Creek from the Santee River. The river road, the 18th century river road, rode right by the springs. and there were two bold springs there down in pits. The area there is underlain with limestone. And the water dissolves the limestone. The water's a little acid, and it dissolves the limestone and makes these sinks, which are look kind of like V-shaped pits. And the limestone is full of cracks and crevices and creeks and underground rivers and the things like that. And so every time there's one of these pits, there's a bold stream in the bottom, which we surface dwellers called a spring. So Utah Springs was in one hole, then it went in an underground tunnel and came out in another hole that emptied into the headwaters and made this little creek. So the water would have been really good and nice and cold in August and September of 1781 in South Carolina, and it was a great place to camp, especially since this road right there, this is the Monk's Corner Road that went on the Monk's Corner where the head of supplies was, and that's what you're looking for. So the supplies hadn't quite come up, but it's early sweet potato season. The Santee River in this area was granted out starting right around 1700. So there were, by 1781, 80-year-old mature established farms. Plantation just means farm, along the river here. And they were growing a good root crop imported from South America called sweet potatoes. And so if you're hungry and you can go out in the field and dig up somebody else's sweet potatoes, that is a good source of nutrition, and they're very good eats. So early in the morning, every morning that they were in camp, Alexander Stewart had told each one of his units to take roughly 10% of their people, put them on detail, and go in this area right here and gather up, you know, a day or two or three's worth of sweet potatoes. Now, at first, when I started looking at this, I said, well, what they're doing is just going to the plantations and stealing the stuff out of their root cellars. But in the group that is researching this is an old sweet potato farmer, and he said, Charles, this is the first week of September. These are, you know, they aren't still in the ground. They hadn't dug them up and had a chance to put them up yet. So the soldiers were literally out there, probably taking their bayonets and digging in the ground to gather up sweet potatoes. So here we have the setup. We have Green stopped in this area, giving everybody 2 gills of rum. You have about 10% or so of Stuart's soldiers, no, probably more like 15-18%, out here gathering sweet potatoes. So these two deserters go into Colonel Stewart's camp and say, hey, we're deserters from the Continental Army. We love you. We want to join your team. Please don't kill us yet. And by the way, we left Nathaniel Greene's headquarters where he has the whole American Army, and there's at least 4,000 of them, which is probably twice what he had. But you know, these soldiers didn't know that. And probably they couldn't count, and 4,000 would be the equivalent of a 4-year-old telling you there's a gazillion of them. This is a lot. So Stewart said, oh, that can't be possible, because I'm paying actual gold to spies to tell me when the Americans leave the camp, and none of my spies have reported this. But he calls up his left-hand man, John Coffin, another New Yorker, to mount up and take his 40 or 50 mounted New Yorkers with him and some 140 very qualified light infantrymen and just go west on the old River Road, Highway 6, which is right here out this way, and tell me what you see. You know, is there really anybody out there? Are these guys just joshing me? Because if you find nothing, I'm going to kill them. I'm going to hang them. Because they're obviously here spying on me. So Green gets through with issuing a little rum to his troops. And they're here. This is called St. Julian's Plantation. And St. Julian's Plantation is fascinating because the original land grants for St. Julian's way before the Revolutionary War have virtually the same property lines as they did now. And so I asked Miss Margaret to help me find St. Julian's property lines and find John Burdell's, and she was kind enough to very quickly lay it out where St. Julian's was. So St. Julian's plantation is all in this area right here. John Coffin's cavalry comes trotting out here, and they're moving pretty fast. I mean, they have fresh men and fresh horses, and, you know, it's early in the morning. It's daylight because, you know, the days get, it gets plenty light by 6 o'clock in early September. And they run into the advance guard of Nathanael Greene's army. I don't think Coffin was really expecting to find the whole Southern rebel army, but he did. And he fell into a trap. Light Horse Harry Lee was in charge, that's Robert E. Lee's father, was in charge of this advance, the van, the spearhead, the forward troops. And they called, and he called it a trap. In the middle on the road, and this is a narrow one wagon wide road, was his light infantry, was Lee's Legion infantry. But what you couldn't see is a couple hundred yards out on each side were horsemen, were cavalry. So if you ride down the road and see these troops, you don't see any horsemen, you just see some infantry. Well, Coffin's group is mounted, and mounted men, you know, have a height advantage, and they're armed mainly with swords, so it can be pretty devastating. So Coffin goes charging in, and shots are fired, which immediately set these flankers into the fray. Well, you know, there's probably 400 horsemen, maybe 200 on each side, and Coffin's got maybe 50, and so he's outnumbered. Plus, Lee's Legion infantrymen, the infantrymen here on the road, are not ragtag farmer militiamen. These are hardened, battle-hardened professional soldiers. So there's quite a skirmish there. Now, the other thing that's interesting geographically, and I'm talking to people I know who are fascinated by studying the lives of these people, you know, our ancestors and the people who were from this area. I'm interested in that, but I'm real fascinated in knowing where all this stuff happened. But if you'll look at my map, you'll see that there's a little bend in the road right there. And that bend in the road is still there. And what that means is this. If your whole army or an 18-wheeler truck, for instance, is on this side, and you're coming from this side, it's just enough bend there where you can't see around the bend. So you can get really close together, and just by happen chance, you know how luck dictates so much. Green is coming from the west side, Coffin's coming from the east side. They can't see each other coming. And they're within, I'd say, less than 100 yards before they even see each other. And they're probably both making enough noise with all the horses and wagons and people grumbling about marching. And, of course, they've just got a little rum in them, so they're probably a little bit louder. And they probably can't hear each other coming till they bump into each other. Well, the Americans had a really nice victory there. They killed a number of people. They captured about 10 dragoons. They captured, I think, 45 of the light infantry troops, which in terms of smaller skirmishes in the Revolutionary War, I think they lost one person. It's a huge victory for the Americans. Well, that set into action a chain of events, kind of like a little nuclear reaction. The sound of the skirmish, all the people who are way up in here gathering sweet potatoes heard the sound of the skirmish. And the sweet potato harvesters that are the closest to Green are the what we call the bus. That's the 3rd Regiment of foot of the British Army. Now, this is the cream of the old, one of the oldest established units of the British Army. So when they hear a fight, they turn and go to the fight. It's kind of like my Scots-Irish ancestors, I think. They are, you know, they would come to a fight because they wanted to get in on it. But these guys knew to come. Now, they were armed, gathering potatoes. They had four cartridges each. So they were not heavily armed. And, of course, they were expecting to gather food and not particularly to get in a fight. So the sweet potato diggers come in, but what they don't know is they're coming into the whole American army. And so of the 310, give or take, sweet potato diggers that are out in the field, Greene is able to capture about 200 of them. Now, before he gets into this battle, if he had turned around and gone back to Sumter County, he would have had a great victory because he's lost, I think, one person, and he's captured 250 roughly British and killed another dozen more of them. So that, in Revolutionary War terms, is a big deal and a big victory. But that's not where it stopped, of course. Coffin's men take off. The cavalry goes back to deliver the message to Stuart. Hey, this is real. They're 3 miles out there. Their whole army is there. All these blue-coated Continentals are there. You better beat General Quarters because we're getting ready to get attacked. There's about 100 light infantrymen left, and they are beating it back toward Eutaw Springs down this road too, but they can't quite go as fast as the horses can running, because I can tell you they were moving. Light infantrymen are the most athletic. These are your running backs and your ends on the football team, a whole group of them, 100 of them. And so going and running 3 miles to them is no big deal, but they not only can run 3 miles, they can have a full load, and they can stop and set up ambushes and fight. And so we don't have very good descriptions of that, but we do have enough evidence of skirmishing along the way. They couldn't stop Greene's army, but they sure could slow it down, and they could take shots. Now, in this little research project, we had the advantage, of course, the internet, which is a very powerful research tool. And we had the advantage of aerial LIDAR. And this, an aerial LIDAR, comes from an airplane. It's like radar, but instead of using radio waves, it uses a laser. And it shoots a laser at the ground, and it times how long it takes the light to bounce back to the airplane and creates an elevation. It has the ability, though, to look through the vegetation. So if you Agent Oranged the whole area around Eutaw Springs, so Eutawville would be down in here. This is the modern alignment of Highway 6. This is the colonial alignment of the road. This is the topography you would see. There's an interesting line right there on the map. You can see it right there. That is the abandoned railroad bed from Eutawville to a disappeared town of Ferguson, which was a logging town, started about 1900 on the Santee River. So if you go there now and walk that line, you would see, what you see in an old abandoned railroad grade. What we were looking for when we did this is we were looking for what the topography would look like when Greene's men fanned out across here and started moving toward the British camp. We were also looking for an elusive landmark that is mentioned in the 18th century emails called the Road to Roaches. Now, I didn't know this. I didn't do very well in French in high school, but I understand roaches, it just means rock. So it's the road rocks or Rockies. And we knew that some of the early 19th century historians had identified the continuation of the River Road as the Road to Roaches, and said it was Patrick Roaches. The problem is, that Patrick Roach didn't own a plantation on that road. And so it didn't make any sense why Stuart, the British commander, would say, I put my line across the road to Roach's. Because that would mean way back in here somewhere, when we know that the Americans are coming this way and that this is the British camp. So we needed to know where the road to Roach's really was. And so we looked at this road here. See, that's a prominent road. And we looked at this road right here. This one here is behind the British line, so you wouldn't make any, the statement wouldn't make any sense. This road here is a roadbed of an old road. Haven't done archaeology to date the road yet, but it appears, and if you look at it now, you can't hardly see that it's there, but it appears that this is a road that could possibly go to Roach's. The problem is we need to find, well, who is Roach? And did he have a plantation? So I can claim no credit for this work, but Dr. Steve Katzberg from here in Orangeburg and Dick Watkins from St. Matthews took this task on. And you would think that that would be just really easy to figure this out, but they worked on it for months. But it turns out that if you go down this road, down to about the floor, 2.5 miles roughly, there was a plantation called Wampee. Now, there's a bunch of Wampee plantations in South Carolina, so Wampee is obviously an Indian name probably that means something like silly Englishmen want to buy swamp from us. Something like that. But anyway, Francis Roach owned a plantation about 2.5 miles south of here on this road, so then we knew where the road from Roach's was. So that's an aerial photograph of the area. That is Bell's Marina right there, a famous landmark. And here is the current 2.5 acre Utah Springs Battlefield Park. And so this is the trace of the so-called road to Roach's. Say, Charles, why do you care about that? Well, when you're trying to put the battle on the map, if you can read the 18th century letters and make sense of the landmarks, then you can begin to put where the battle happened. There was a lawyer from Charleston named William Johnson who became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. And evidently, back then, when you were the Chief Justice of the United States, you didn't have all that much to do, and you had a nice salary. So a lot of them became historians. So William Johnson is not a professional historian, but he decided to write a masterpiece book on the life of Nathanael Greene. And it is a masterpiece book, and it is not shoddy work at all. But when the Chief Justice calls you up on the phone in 1705 and says, would you come over to dinner? I would like to talk to you about the Battle of Cowpens, the Battle of Guilford Courthouse, the Battle of Hopkirk Hill, 96, Utah Springs. You come. Now, those memories, those 25-year-old memories can get foggy. And some, I know y'all are going to find this amazing, but sometimes old soldiers maybe blow up their role in events a little bit, especially after the fifth glass of claret. So someone for Justice Johnson drew this map. And this map, this shows Utah Springs and the houses and the British lines and the American lines. And this map is what I call stylized, which means that it is not accurate to what the ground is, and everything's at little straight lines and little right angles, unlike how roads actually run. But it is a map that kind of has everything on it in kind of the right direction and kind of the right layout. Normally, when we study Revolutionary War battlefields, the winners write glowing letters back to their bosses and include maps that are drawn on the site, you know, to show their brilliance and how they maneuvered, how the other team maneuvered. so you can kind of teach the other, you know, your other peers and your bosses how to prepare and how to fight the British. That, if that happened in this battle, we've not been able to locate it. You would think that there were no surviving battles from period eyewitnesses, but really on most battles there are. But we've never found anything. So all of the scholarship from the early 19th century on pretty much copied this map and took it as gospel. Now, I don't know why they would have done that, except that I know now, working with this group to make wonderful phased battle maps, how much trouble it is. And I have also learned as a non-historian how most historian, most professionally trained historians hate geography. They do. And they'll write down stuff that is just geographically impossible. So this is where the Battle of Utah Springs started. And as a matter of fact, if you go to West Point today and take military history, a version of this map is what they're using to teach. This map is based on what's on the, actually on the ground. Now, the run of Utah Creeks, mile and a half long, goes from the little military park here where the springs were, is now a branch of Lake Marion. And so someone about 50 years ago, and I don't know why they did it, but they wrote down that the Battle of Utah Springs has been flooded and is all gone. Well, it's easy to write stuff like that now, especially if you don't know where anything was. But our study, we believe that maybe 5% of the Utah Springs battlefield is gone, and 95% of it is above land. So Greene gets about a mile away from the British camp, and he comes out and he lines his army up in good European linear fashion. He has his militia on the front to take the front first shots, and behind him, them, he has his Continental soldiers, and behind that, he has William Washington's Dragoons and Robert Kirkwood's Light Infantry. Three lines. Now, if you have ever studied much about the Revolutionary War in the South, you know that Daniel Morgan's brilliant victory over Tarleton at Cowpens was done with three lines, with the militia in the front told, pick those officers off that and sergeants off those horses, take two shots, and then run like hell. Yeah. Well, guess what? The knowledge of what had worked so well at Cowpens, Greene tried to emulate that at his other battles, at Guilford Courthouse, at Hopkirk Hill in Camden, and again here. 96 is a siege, so that doesn't really apply. So this is the layout of the battle. Once again, the elusive road to Roaches, we have identified where it was, and we know that's about where Stuart's lines were. And from the lines here to the house, I would say is about 500 yards, give or take. I measured it, but I've forgotten the exact measurement. I have a friend who's a novelist. And novelists are wonderful in that they're not constrained by... He's a historical fiction writer, great guy, Charles Price. And he drew using the old stylized map, because Utah Springs is just like it is here on the stylized map. Here is the barn, here's the McKelvey house, here's the palisaded garden, and here's the springs. The British camp, all in this area, there's about 8 acres cleared, which would have been full of the British camp, because the British camp is tents, horses, cattle, sheep, commissary wagons, hospitals, and vaults. That's what they call their latrine. They knew that this side of the camp was where the Americans would come from if they came. So guess where they would have dug their vaults? Right along the woods line there. So here's the American side, and here is my friend Charles Price's fanciful drawing of what that might have looked like. And I think he's really pretty good. The battle lines close. Green is doing the advancing. Stuart is not advancing. What has happened, though, and what is very interesting, is the Utah Creek is down in about a 20-foot deep valley. This is limestone country. The water has eroded. Instead of the creek running on the surface, it's eroded down like a little itty-bitty Grand Canyon. And this is in the coastal plain, so everything's pretty darn flat other than that. And you've got a mile and a half long from Utah Springs by the brick house here that runs out at a 45-degree angle to the Santee River. And Green's line are coming up against men that are posted in the trees along the run of Utah Creek. And that's going to become really important because this thing is as wide as a double-lane road that you could pass two 18-wheelers on the bottom. It's 20 feet deep at least, so you can't shoot at it. And it's got pretty steep banks. Charles, how do you know that? It's full of water. Two ways. It's really easy. Number one, there's a topographic map that was made before the lake was flooded. And fishermen love these fishing charts, bathymetric charts that shows you what's underwater, and you can see it on both of those charts. So there's a general combat. The American militia, under the command of a fellow named Francis Marion, holds their own out here in the front. It is written that the militia, who usually have the reputation in a line battle of throwing their weapons down and running, fired 17 rounds, which is all they would have had, and so they fought probably for over an hour and moved the British line back. Eventually, the militia run out of ammunition and fade back in this direction, back to the west through the Continentals. The Continentals are armed with mainly French Charleville muskets. But the point of a musket is really not to shoot anybody with it because they're pretty inaccurate and pretty slow to fire, but is to put that 18-inch piece of steel knife on the end of it called a bayonet and charge with the bayonet. That's the most likely way to get killed in an 18th century European-style battle. And that's what happened. They fought all the way into the British camp. The whole of Utah Springs area, the battlefield is over a square mile. It was all trees except for 8 acres of cleared ground. One officer present said that our lines that were going to walk through the British camp and capture the British got disordered in the tent city, and some of the soldiers stopped to raid the tents. Well, an artist in the 1960s drew up this representation of the American Army. I think this is BS because, number one, if a British soldier was caught with alcoholic beverage in his tent, that is a court-martialable offense, and they flogged you for it, so you didn't really want to get flogged. Number two, the supplies, they had plenty of rum, the British did, but they were all carefully controlled by the quartermaster because it would be destroyed after the battle. And number three, the brick houses in the background has about 100 people taking turns shooting at you through the tents out the windows. Now, you'd have to be pretty brave to want to stop and break into a tent when you've got 100 people on high ground shooting at you. I'm not saying nobody stopped to get a drink of water. They probably did. But it was a mess. Interestingly, Charles Frazier, a wonderful artist from Charleston, drew this depiction of the house at Utah Springs. A lot of the historians compounding the Road to Roaches issue started calling this the Roach House. So I asked my friend Dick Watkins to take a look at it, and I figured he could do this in an hour or so. Not true. It took weeks of very, very detailed work to figure out that no roach ever owned this house, that it was property of the McKelvey family, and that Margaret McKelvey had owned it till she died, and she left it to his son, to her son, Charles, who died, we don't know when or where, in 1781. So this is the McKelvey house. Now, I've looked at the terrain depicted here and the description that soldiers gave of the brick house, which is what most of them called it, and it really didn't look like this house. And this house is in strange territory indeed. And so I think that this is his fanciful representation of it. I don't think that as an adult, the house was still standing. Now, when you put together a group of interesting professionals to take a look at something, we happen to have some engineers on our team. And just like the limestone that was underneath the ground at Utahville cracked and had creeks and stuff running through it, if you build a big, heavy brick house on it like that, guess what? It's going to crack and fall in. And so pretty soon after the 1880s, 90s, sometimes in there, the house evidently, it was not that damaged, and it wasn't burned during the war. It wasn't that hit with many cannon fire. We think it just, the foundations failed, and it became a brick pile, because we know in the 1907-8, when Sinclair was building his Utah's plantation, that they mined brick out of the brick pile here to build the foundation of the Utah's house, which was about a half a mile away. So what happens, and there's Marion leading the band, again, another representation of the Utah's house in the background. I like this painting. This is Robert Wilson. So the British fall back into their camp. They have three strongholds. Number one, they have the declivity, that is the springs and the creek leading from the spring. So you got a hole you can get down in. You can be almost totally covered up. It'd be like being in a fortress. And work the north flank of Greene's army over. Not to mention the fact that there's 300 crack British troops down there. Number two, you've got the brick house right there, which is a fortress in and of itself. It was two stories high with rooms in the attic. So you really have a three-story high house on fairly flat land that you can rain lead down on your enemies. And number three, the garden, that is the green area here to the north of the house, was palisaded. And it was not palisaded as a fort. It was palisaded so you could grow something and keep the deer and the other animals out of the garden. But being, you know, a natural defense, because you're talking about a substantial fence, the British lined up in the creek here. They climbed up in the house. They got in this palisaded garden, and Greene's troops could not dislodge them. Greene moved his cannon forward. He was going to try to blast the house down. Before the cannon got off any shots, or more than just a handful, the British came out and actually captured Greene's cannon. William Washington decides, and he is George Washington's second cousin, much younger. He's a cavalry commander, Continental. He goes over to the edge of the problem area, which is Utah Creek Bank, and says, well, I'm going to take my cavalry right over here through these blackjacks, and I'm going to capture these guys and eliminate this problem. But what happens is he himself gets captured, and artist Don Trione has memorialized William Washington's moment of, oh my, whatever he said, something like that, when he was surrounded by all these guys with these sharp bayonets, any one of whom could kill him. Now, he did end up getting wounded and falling off his horse, and the British knew they had a high-value prisoner, so they treated him pretty well. They gave him parole down in Charleston. He marries Jane Elliott. And Jane Elliott was a poor little teenage orphan girl who owned, I think, 8 successful rice plantations. Her parents had died, and making her probably the richest person in South Carolina. So he did okay by himself. That's a little picture Vincent Lawson drew of the spring. It's down a hole. Interestingly, these are alligators, so he was fascinated with that, and cypress knees. But you can see the declivity from the level of the water to the edge of the hole in which the spring ran from this 1874 sketch. We are extremely fortunate to have this photograph. And this is Utah Creek, pre-flooding, of course, how wide the bottom is. But what you can't see is right over here and right over here would be those steep 20-foot high walls in which the creek flowed, in which the British were able to use as cover. Okay, so end of the story. Let me back up one. Stuart is able to hold his ground. 5 hours of hard fighting, no water, no significant supply of water. The Americans have captured a British cannon. 2 of Greene's cannons have come off their carriages, just, you know, from being shot so much. And Greene decides to withdraw to fight again. This is the area in here that is the main battle area. So you can see the size of it, because here's Utah Springs, the Santee River. Here's the old alignment of the highway. And this goes back here 7 miles to Burdell's Tavern. I am proud to say that there is not only the research to try to figure out what happened where, but property is being acquired by cooperation of non-for-profit conservation organizations and the federal government. And for example, the restaurant that was right here at the 1 mile mark, called the Chef's Choice, is sitting right in the middle of the battlefield. It's been purchased and preserved. There are ongoing contracts for other property in this area, an ongoing property back up this road, especially in this area where the night battle was. So that, I mean, we'll never get all this because, you know, there's all kind of houses and stuff in here. And so there's nobody's trying to buy all those houses. But we want to have at least enough area where you can have a pull-off, where cars can get off the road safely, and where there'll be signage to interpret what happened where. Now this, after the battle, both sides claim victory, as they want to do. It was a victory for the British in that they still held the brick house, even though they'd been pushed out of their camp. The British took twice as many, roughly, casualties, and Stuart could not maintain the position again. So this is the third in Greene's battles that he didn't clearly win, but he accomplished the goal of running the British out of the area. The day after the battle, it rained cats and dogs, so neither army did much. The following day, Stuart mounted up, left a number of his sick and wounded behind, and retreated to Monk's Corner. Nathaniel Greene had hundreds of prisoners, had hundreds of sick and wounded. He tended to those, he got them across the Santee River as best he could, and then he went back on the attack mode and moved his army down as far as Ferguson Swamp, which is now right in the middle of Lake Moultrie. So he moved his army within 7 miles of Monk's Corner. So he is on the prowl pushing the army. Now I know I'm out of time. I've gone on way too long. I hope to get to talk to as many of you as I can, especially if you have questions about Utah Springs. I did bring with me a copy of what we call the Order of Battle, which is the list of officers on both sides and what units that they were with. And I brought also with me just a few little notes that I have on the Orangeburg Loyalist Militia. Thank you all very much.
John, what happened to
Luther
Sara Lee in that battle?
That, Luther, is a complicated question. Toward the end of the battle, Greene wanted Lee to lead his cavalry on an attack sort of like this, around the south and then up to the north. He looked for Lee and couldn't find Lee. And Lee's cavalry commander is a guy named Joseph Eggleston. For you Civil War buffs, Joseph Eggleston Johnson was his namesake. Eggleston led the charge, but unsuccessfully. And so Greene, being a good politician as he was, only said nice things about Lee from Virginia. But the officer corps ribbed Lee, and within 4 months, Lee had decided that he wanted out, and he quit and went home.
We can take one or two more questions. Any more questions?
Yes, sir.
Where was Charles Middleton Stark?
Charles Stark Middleton.
Yeah.
Interesting guy. I don't know too much about him. Dick believes that he was a smart guy just like William Washington, and that he married Danger Thompson's daughter. It's a good idea, I think. My father told me that you can marry more in 5 minutes than you can make in a lifetime. But just like everything else he told me, I didn't listen to him.
But he was injured here, was he not?
I do not know that.
He was wounded there.
The interesting thing is that you almost never have too much cavalry in a battle. But Greene had the most cavalry of any. I think there were 8 different pieces of cavalry regiments, including Middleton's. And about half of them were attached to William Henderson on this flank. William Henderson gets wounded severely over here early in the battle. And about the other half of them were attached down here, either with or just in front of Lee's Legion infantry. I do not know off the top of my head, I'm not sure if I have it written down or not, whether Middleton was here or here. Greene had so much cavalry at the battle, I tried to figure out, well, what would you do with that many horsemen? You can't keep them very long because they eat so much. But he had all those prisoners. And so when you have hundreds of prisoners, using some cavalry that you don't know how steady they are to escort prisoners back would be one of the things that you might do. Plus, this is a huge battlefield. Even toward the end, from here to here is about a half a mile. And so a lot of the cavalrymen get pressed into duty of being so-called aides-de-camp or messengers or deputy adjutants or things like that, so that there can be some command and control on the battlefield. I can probably look and see if I actually know, but that's the best I can do off the top of my head.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thank you.